All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. What has been going on? What is it, Monday? How was the weekend? Where you been? What's happening? How's everything for you? Are you all right? Are you all right? I'm a little tired. I'm a little strung out from the road. I left for the Midwest on Tuesday. I did Madison, Wisconsin, Wednesday night, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Thursday night, Chicago, Illinois on Friday night. And then on Saturday, we topped it off with Minneapolis. Great shows. I got some stories, maybe. What do you think? But I don't want to, I want to set up today's show. I want to set up today's show early on so you know what's about to happen. I talked to Carol Burnett. Now, Carol Burnett, I'm 60. I don't know how old you are, but I'm 60. And Carol Burnett, from my childhood, in my childhood, watching Carol Burnett shows when I was very young, was one of the most exciting and hilarious things I remember about my childhood. Just her, Conway, Vicki Lawrence, Lyle Wagner, Harvey Korman. I mean, these were some of the funniest people that ever lived. And I remember watching the show when it was on the air when I was a kid. And now when I was researching her to interview her, I was going back and watching some of that stuff. And it is just so great. She is just so great. And man, we've been trying to do this interview for years. And we always told them that we'd make it work however we could. And she'd been in LA doing press for Palm Royale, but I was out of town. So what I did was I drove up to Montecito. It was a thunderstorm. It was ridiculous. I mean, like just flooding rain. And I met her at we set up a room at a hotel for the interview. Her people brought her down. We had to drive, get little golf carts around. It was very slippery. She's very spry, very agile minded. She's all there and she's amazing. She's 90 years old. It's amazing. And I was nervous. I get nervous in general when you travel. I get nervous about the equipment. I get nervous about, you know, how I'm going to engage with people, how with such a legend as well. And I don't know, man. I went into the room, I set up, and we just sat down and did it. And it was just an honor and a great conversation. And I don't know, brings back a lot of memories. I think I brought back some memories for her, some memories from the show, from her childhood. But it was just so I'm so glad that I got to do it, because there are some interviews that I never got to do, but I got to do this one, and it's pretty great. Folks, I'm in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. I'll be in Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center, Glenside, Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater, Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater, Munhall, Pennsylvania outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall, Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at Playhouse Square, Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my dates and links to tickets. Wow. What a series of shows. I'm like, I'm out of it, man. I don't even, you know, I went out there, we flew out. Now look, I told you recently about my anxiety, but like sometimes I'm just nuts. I mean, sometimes like it'll be a week before I leave and I'll be saying to myself, oh fuck, where am I gonna park in Milwaukee? I mean, what does that have to, I mean, is there no better use for my brain? But yeah, we had some obstacles, but some interesting lessons along the way. I went out there with Ali Makovsky, who's a comic who I've known from the Comedy Store for a little while. And she's open for me here in town, but I've never taken her out on the road with me. And it was great. She killed. She was funny. We had a good time. We ate good food. We drove around strange cities. It's fun. I mean, if you have somebody you can travel with on the road, because there's a lot of driving involved and flying. And I didn't know if it would be great, but it was pretty fun. And she was very funny. And the shows worked great. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. We've been supported by Squarespace for years, and not just as a sponsor. Squarespace also powers our website, WTFpod.com. So whether you're just starting out or you're managing an existing company or brand, Squarespace makes it easy to set yourself up with a beautiful website and get all the tools that'll help you engage with your audience. They have a completely new design system called Squarespace Blueprint, and that's where you'll get started. Build your online presence from the ground up with a professional layout and style options. Then get to work on all the added features that will make your site a place where customers and fans can get everything they want. Make checkout seamless with simple but powerful payment tools. Use Squarespace AI to help you write descriptions or any other kind of short or long form text you need. Go to squarespace.com/WTF for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the code WTF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/WTF. Offer code WTF. Get started today. Now, with this anxiety thing, I mean, it's weird. I don't think I show my gratitude for technology enough. I should explain that, because here's what happened. And look, I've talked about this a lot lately, but I've just exhausted my energy resources, I think, for my life. But we're flying, Allie and I are flying from Los Angeles to Chicago. And then we were going to get a plane from Chicago to Madison, which was ultimately unnecessary. I don't know why we booked it. My manager booked it, but it's fine. But we were going to rent a car in Madison, then drive Madison to Milwaukee, and then Milwaukee down to Chicago, and then fly to Minneapolis and fly home the next day. It's a lot of running around. But the initial plan was we were going to fly from Chicago to Madison. So we're in the air from Los Angeles to Chicago, and I get a text on my phone. It's from American Airlines. The flight from Chicago to Minneapolis has been canceled. And then Allie texts me from the back of the plane. You got to pay your dues. Texts me from the back of the plane that the flight's been canceled. I was like, I know. And then she was looking around. She found a United flight. Then my manager got involved. So now I'm texting with my manager and Allie in the back of the plane about this United flight. And then it became apparent that it was about weather. So who knows what was going to happen if there was even a United flight. Then I'm like, fuck this. Let's just rent a car when we get to Chicago and drive to Madison. How bad could the weather be? So I reserved a car at Hertz. All of this happened on my phone in the air before we even landed. And it was easy. So I just got to be a little bit grateful sometimes, because 10 years ago, do you know what would have happened 10 years ago? You wouldn't have even known. You would not have even known until you got off the plane in Chicago, walked out of the gate, looked at one of those boards, and just went, oh, fuck. God damn it. The fucking flight to Minneapolis is canceled. Doesn't look that bad out there. I mean, what are they doing? Can't they just fly in this? And then you would have scrambled over to the American counter. Is there another flight? Can we get another flight? What's the next flight? There is no other flights. Tomorrow morning's the next time you can get it out. God damn it. And then you go running. Then the running in the airport starts. Running to another airline. They tell you at American, maybe United, you can get on the United flight. They got one going out. So you're running. And Chicago, that's a big run. That's a lot of running with your luggage at night. And you run to United. They're like, it's all booked up. And then it's like, God damn it. I guess we'll have to sleep here at an airport hotel. Wait, let's just go to Hertz. I can call Hertz. I'll call Hertz in Chicago and see if they have a car. That could take forever. So you decide to go to Hertz. You don't even know if they have a car. None of that happened just because of Wi-Fi on the plane. None of that happened. That doesn't mean it didn't happen in my mind. So I did experience a little bit of anxiety at moments because I lived it. I just recounted it for you, and it didn't happen. So sometimes a little gratitude is in order. Yes. So we drove from Chicago to Madison, stayed at that same hotel I always stay at in Madison. Madison is a good town, but it was snowing for 2 days. It was snowing. And I remember I talked to you about it on last, what was it, Thursday, sitting in that room looking at that snow, thinking like, this is my life. Got to the gym that first day. And then just beat the fuck out of myself for not doing it for the next four. The gym at that hotel was all right. There's some good ones. Okay, this one was pretty good. Had like seven treadmills, a couple bikes, had mats, it had weights, had all the stuff you need. It was big enough. It was big to hold all that. But I was still the only guy there, and it's still kind of lonely in a hotel gym. Now, I don't know what it is with my brain. I mean, it's only an hour, but for some reason in a hotel gym, the entire process of it, I don't know. It runs deeper than that. I mean, it was okay because of the size. But if you're in one of those hotel gyms that's just two treadmills and maybe a couple of weights and you're on that treadmill, holy shit. It feels like you're the last person alive. It's like it's like an existential crisis almost in a weird way. A type of loneliness that can't quite be an active loneliness. And all you're doing is hoping that no one gets on that one other treadmill right next to you, because the intimacy would just be too much to bear. Just two people running futilely from death in a hotel gym. Maybe I'm being dramatic, but there is something. I mean, look, most of you, myself included, when you're at home, it takes a lot. But when you're in a hotel, for some reason, when there's absolutely nothing else to do, the idea of getting down to that gym, even if it's for an hour, even like, and that's the only thing that I can do to make things happen sometimes, is clock it. Like, how long is this really going to take? How long does it really take you to do anything? Anytime you're like, I don't want to do that, time it. I mean, really ask yourself, what is the thing you're dreading? It might take 3.5 minutes to do that thing. So just fucking do it. That's how I get through it. I don't know if I've shared that advice with you, but that's how I get through it. Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes, and it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security. It's the home security option we've been recommending for 8 years. When we first installed SimpliSafe, we did it ourselves, and it took less than an hour to get the whole thing up and running. Just a fraction of our spring cleaning time, but that's not the only reason we love it. SimpliSafe is great because it protects your whole home. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more, plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day, so you'll get a response right away when you need it most. SimpliSafe has given us and many WTF listeners real peace of mind. You should have that peace of mind too. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for the Fast Protect monitoring at simplisafe.com/WTF. That's SimpliSafe.com/WTF. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Okay, look, this is it. This is happening. Carol Burnett is a legend. It was a thrill and an honor to sit down with her for an hour and talk. She's in a new series called Palm Royale. It's now streaming on Apple TV Plus. You can watch the first 5 episodes right now, with new episodes premiering Wednesdays. This was a treat, and I was a bit nervous. But this is me talking to Carol Burnett. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a 3-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcast. Casts. You know, the last time I drove up here for an interview was to talk to Jonathan Winters.
Oh, Johnny.
Yeah, that was something. You know, it wasn't long before he passed away, but he was one of those guys where, you know, the guy who set it up said, we'll see what kind of day it is for him.
Oh, got it. I knew him very well. We had the same manager when we started out in New York.
Oh, really?
And I have two of his original paintings in my house that he gave me.
Oh, that's so great.
They're so, he was a good artist.
Sure. And he lived up here, right? I mean, he lived nearby.
Oh, yeah. And he would hold court a lot at the local delicatessen.
Right. And also he would, like when I saw him, we went to lunch and he would wear his Civil War, his hat. And it was quite an outing. Because when we were at that house, you know, it was just so interesting that, and I tell this story and I don't know if people really appreciate it. You know, he's got this, you know, that house out there in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
He's got that wall full of photos of a whole life in show business.
Oh my
right?
God, yeah.
And we're walking by it, and he just stops at this one picture, and it's like an ancient picture of just a boy and his dog. And he says, I miss that dog.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh, wow.
Out of all those pictures?
Oh, that's so funny. Bless him.
Right? Uh-huh. So you've been interviewed a lot, uh-huh. And I think as a guy who's sitting here talking to you, out of all the interviewers that you've engaged with, who was your most favorite to do?
Well, there wasn't one particular, but I think Merv Griffin actually was wonderful.
Yeah.
Because that was back in the days when you didn't go on to plug anything.
Right, right, yeah.
You just went on to talk.
To hang out.
And to hang out with him. And he was and he never had notes.
Yeah.
Or anything. It was like you were out to dinner with him.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The other one I had fun with, and I did the whole 90 minutes, was Dick Cavett.
Oh, yeah.
And that was fun.
Yeah, and that was when it was sort of like, you know, a bunch of people came out. So
I was just the only guest that
for
time.
For 90 minutes.
For 90 minutes. And we sang a song together.
Mm.
What was it? A Fine Romance, my friend. This is...
You got Cavett singing, huh?
Got him singing.
Yeah.
And then another one, the other one I only did one, was David Frost.
Oh, he's the British guy, right?
Yeah. And he was, again, none of them had any, we were just talking.
Yes. Yeah.
I wasn't plugging anything.
Why don't we, but that was sort of the way it went back then a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Carson plugged, but it was still a 90
minute
show.
Well, even early on, Carson too was, it was just getting, as you said, hanging.
Did you do it in New York with Carson?
I did. I was always nervous.
Yeah.
To do, because I felt you sit in that chair.
Yeah.
And you have to score.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm not a scorer.
What are you talking about?
No, I'm not. Yeah. I can't, I don't tell jokes and, you know, and so forth. So I decided, and I didn't tell him.
Yeah.
That I would go on and be the world's worst interviewee.
That was the bit.
He didn't know I was going to do it.
Okay.
So, get on.
Yeah.
And this was when my husband and I had moved to Beverly Hills in California.
After New York.
Yeah, so now he's in California.
Right.
So he said, well, I understand that you just moved out here from New York to Beverly Hills. And I said, yes. And he said, and I understand, you know, that you bought Betty Grable's old house, and she was one of your favorite movie stars. That must be quite a thrill. And I went, yes. Well, he caught on.
Oh, he did.
Of course. Then he started these real long questions, and I would just go, maybe. And then the audience started, they got it.
Oh.
And afterwards, he said, that was the most fun.
Because he didn't see it coming.
No, he didn't see it coming. I just thought that maybe that's the way I can score.
Right. You know? Nice slow build.
Yeah.
And he was so quick. Yeah. And I guess once he got it.
Oh, once he got it, he was on it. On a roll.
Yeah. I just watched, for some reason, you know, I watched the entire new show, Palm Royale.
Oh, you did?
I watched the whole series.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I didn't watch every Carol Burnett show yesterday.
Yeah. That would have been quite a
long day. It would have been a lot. But the new show, it's one of those shows that it doesn't really play as a comedy, but it's definitely a comedy, right?
Well, it's a dark comedy.
Dark comedy, exactly. Yeah. And I imagine for you, because like I texted Alice and Jenny yesterday because I interviewed for her. And
we wordle.
That's what she said. She said you wordle every day. And that
we do.
You're her new favorite person. And that's,
back at her. I love her.
Oh, God. The comedy talent on that show.
Well, that's why I did it.
Really?
When they called me to do it, I hadn't read it or I didn't know anything about it. And they said, it's Kristen Wiig, Alice and Jenny, Laura Dern. I'm in.
Yeah.
I don't care. You want me to carry a spear? What do you want me to? And I'm in a coma for
for half of it. Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. But you're doing some face work during the coma.
I guess so.
There are moments where it's like, there was a lip moving. I'm like, that was on purpose. She's getting a laugh in a coma. But when you see somebody like Kristen, because there's not like in terms of comedic actresses.
Oh, she's brilliant.
She's unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
And I think a direct legacy of what you did in the work that, in terms of the courage of it all and the commitment to character. Yeah. And you had fun with her?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we did a lot of, most of my scenes are with her.
Yeah.
So we bonded like crazy. I kind of felt like her mom.
Oh, really?
And so we're in touch. And Allison and Laura, all of us names, who were together.
They're all kind of incredible comedic actresses. Yeah.
And everybody, we got along like a house of fire. There was no temperament, we just had. And the directors were very good with us.
Yeah.
They encouraged us to kind of improvise a bit.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And
a lot of stuff. They said, okay, do another one and do anything you
fun.
Want.
Well, that's fun. That must have given you a little juice.
It did. Yeah.
Because that's like the old days.
Of course. Of course.
Well, I wondered I've interviewed, I guess contemporaries yours. Like I interviewed Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, gosh.
A while back in Malibu. I went out there.
Yeah.
I interviewed Carl Reiner before he passed away.
Yeah.
And that was hilarious.
Yeah.
I've interviewed Mel Brooks, Shelley Berman.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you know Shelley Berman?
Vaguely.
Yeah.
Not well.
Because I noticed, in the first season of the show, there's, so many guests, but not a ton of comics. A few, right? And I just wonder, the different circles, because you came up, you were born in Texas?
1933, and I was born in Texas, San Antonio.
You still have people there?
No. Are you kidding? I'm 9 years old. I got people there.
Well, sometimes there's people that kind
Uncle Methuselah. Yeah, he's there.
He's still there. Yeah. He's 107.
Yeah.
And then you came here.
Yep. I came to Hollywood with my grandmother.
Right.
We moved here to be with my mother, and we lived a block north of Hollywood Boulevard on Yucca and Wilcox.
Oh, I know who that is. Yeah.
And that's where I grew up.
And your mom was in show business?
No. She wanted to be Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper.
Sure. Right. Tabloid journalism.
Well, she interviewed a few movie stars for Pick Magazine. That was an old magazine.
Yeah.
But her dreams never really came true. But she did get to interview Rita Hayworth.
Yeah.
Bob Hope.
When you had them on your show, did you ask them if they remembered your mother?
Oh, I did. Well, of course they wouldn't, know.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but it was so weird, when I, growing up, and Mama said, oh, guess what? I got to interview Rita Hayworth. And she wanted to make a phone call and didn't have any change, so I lent her a nickel. And she said, how about that? Rita Hayworth owes me a nickel.
her big star connection.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But it was a thrill for me. I mean, my gosh, my grandmother and I used to go to the movies all the time.
Sure, yeah.
We'd save our pennies.
Right.
And go to where they had double features. And so there were times when we would go on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, we'd see four movies in a weekend, and there I would see Bing Crosby, I would see Rita Hayworth, I would see Lana Turner, Betty Grable.
Yeah.
And they were on my show.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I watched that clip with Gloria Swanson.
Oh, yeah.
That was crazy.
She said, in her book.
Yeah.
She's got a book, wrote her autobiography, Swanson on Swanson. Yeah. Swanson. And she said that the greatest television experience she had was doing our show.
Yeah.
Yep. She said she just loved it. And the way we rehearsed and got it done. And and she loved doing the tango with the boy dancers.
Sure. Yeah.
And then doing Charlie Chaplin, where I was doing the charwoman with her. And she was like the Energizer Bunny.
Right. Mark,
and she was, how old was she? 76.
It's so wild that your show kind of was at that moment where there was sort of a new guard coming in, but all those actors and actresses were just around.
Right.
And they were willing to play.
Yeah. And, well, I always wanted to, when we would have musical guests like Cheetah Rivera or Gwen Verdon, I would want to put them in sketches because they would do variety shows and they never had an opportunity to be in a sketch.
Oh, to be funny.
Have something other than just doing their number.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Cheetah, I mean, we used her a lot and she was very funny.
She could do it.
And Gwen, of course, and we just had more fun. And so they loved coming on our show because, again, they got to do more than just get up and do their number.
Yeah, yeah, because it was fun.
Yeah.
I was just thinking before, I watched that clip of you and Emmett Kelly.
Oh.
That's kind of a wild clip.
It was sweet.
It's almost like an art piece.
Yeah, well, thank you. That was Look for the Silver Lining. And
Paper Moon,
Paper
I think.
Paper Moon.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it was just such it's strange to think that, you know, so much a part of what physical comics do is kind of clowning. Yeah, in terms of like, you know, and then to see him all sad and quiet.
Yeah.
And,
but I, as a kid, I hated clowns.
Yeah, who doesn't?
I mean, they scared the hell out of me.
A lot of people
were
scared
of clowns.
When we went
to a circus, and I was, and they were hitting each other and banging.
Sure.
And then one of them pointed a gun at me. I'm in the first row, and I'm just like this. And of course, an umbrella came out. But I thought, that's not funny.
Yeah.
I was maybe 6 years old, but it scared me to death.
They are scary.
But Emmett never scared me because there was a sweetness about him.
Yeah, he's the classic sad clown.
Exactly.
And he was around forever, right?
Oh, yeah. It's so sweet.
And really, when he talked, he was sweet?
Oh, adorable. Very sweet.
So now, you didn't grow up with your dad because he was out there, away, right?
No, I didn't grow up with him because they were divorced.
Right.
But he would come and visit.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And so my mother became an alcoholic.
Yeah, the two
they
of
both,
them.
They both, yeah. And even though they were separated and everything, but they got along.
Yeah.
You know, and he would, and there were times when he would be sober and it would just be wonderful. He was, however, he was so much like Jimmy Stewart, and then when he drank, he was like a drunk Jimmy Stewart. He was sweet. I mean, there was never any anger or angst or anything.
Sure.
He was just had that disease.
Yeah, believe me, I've got, I'm in my 25th year sober.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy. It's a long time.
He was sober for a year, I remember, when I was 11.
Yeah.
And it was the best. We had the best time because he lived with his mother, my paternal grandmother, in Santa Monica. And so on the weekends when I wasn't in school, I'd take the streetcar and the bus, and he'd meet me, and I'd be with them all weekend. And we'd go to the movies, and we'd go to, there was Ocean Park, there was roller coasters and the rides there.
It's still there, isn't it? Yeah, I think the rides are still on Santa Monica Pier anyways.
Anyway, that's where we'd go.
Yeah.
And it was just wonderful. And then she died, his mother.
Yeah.
And he came to see me and he was kind of weaving.
Oh, yeah.
And he had had something to drink. So he fell off the wagon and he never recovered.
Oh. Was there AA then?
Yeah. But it wasn't, I think Mama went to one meeting and
didn't
had
stick.
To have a drink afterwards.
It was the old days of it.
Yeah.
It must have been very specific.
Yeah.
Because you watch The Days of Wine and Roses. And
right.
That's sort of, you know, Jack Klugman. That's sort of what it looked like. It was new.
Right.
So your mom never really got sober.
No. Her dreams were crushed.
And
in fact, they both died before they were 50.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. They were 40, 44, 45 years old.
Now, how do you figure you didn't get stuck with that disease?
Well, maybe it skipped a generation. I don't know, because my grandmother, Mama's mama, didn't drink.
And thank God she was around for stability, right?
Well, she was a hypochondriacal Christian Scientist.
Oh, so no doctors constantly thinking she's dying?
Yes. But then if if she didn't feel well or anything, and if it didn't work, Christian Science, she'd pop a phenobarbital.
Oh, so.
So, as I said, a hypochondriacal Christian Scientist. So she had that backup.
Yeah.
And it was aspirin and phenobarbitals and all of that.
And like in looking at it now, like, I mean, because I know you've talked about sobriety, you know, and looking back at your childhood, was there a framework that you were able to sort of understand yourself better once you got more aware of like what the disease of alcoholism is?
I didn't really know that it was a disease.
Right.
I thought that, you know, my dad said when he was sober, he said, I'm haven't had a drink and I won't as long as you pray for me.
Oh, yeah.
So when he started to drink again, I said, I prayed for you.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't. I prayed and prayed and prayed, you know, so he laid that on me, but it wasn't to hurt my feelings.
Sure.
He just felt, you know.
It was a way to ease the responsibility a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, codependency is its own thing, right? So,
but I was able to kind of, I don't know, disappear at times.
Yeah.
In myself, I loved to draw. Yeah. I would sit in the corner where my grandmother and mother would be arguing about money and liquor.
Yeah.
And I would sit in the corner and I would just draw and lose myself. Yeah. And Mama always said, oh, well, there's Carol, she's pulled her veil down.
Yeah.
So I could.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah. And so it bothered me. And Mama lived down the hall, and I was with my grandmother. And we had one room.
Yeah.
With a Murphy bed.
Right.
That she slept on, and I slept on the couch.
Oh, my God.
Until I was 21.
Really?
I never had a bed.
That's crazy. But I guess that's just the way it was.
I had a bed.
Yeah.
I slept on the couch.
Oh, you must have been so happy to get out.
Well, I got the chance to go to New York.
But when you were a kid, you weren't necessarily funny? You didn't think?
Nope. Nor did I know I could sing.
Really?
Mm-mm. I wanted to be a journalist.
Yeah.
Or a cartoonist.
Yes.
And Mama, of course, she wrote, you know, she said, that's great. Be a journalist, you know, and so and so forth. And so I was graduating from Hollywood High.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go to UCLA.
Yeah.
And major in journalism.
Sure.
But we couldn't afford the tuition to UCLA. You know how much it was?
How much?
Guess. At that time, 1951.
For a whole year? Or, I don't know, $500?
$43.
For the year?
For the term.
Wow.
And we didn't have it. Our rent was $30 a month.
Yeah.
And we barely made that.
Yeah.
But so I said to Nanny, my grandmother, she said, go to Woodbury Secretarial School so that you could be a secretary and nab the boss. Yeah.
That was the plan.
Nab the boss. Get a guy.
Get the guy with money.
Right.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to go to, I know. I saw myself on campus.
Yeah.
Mark, I didn't know how I was going to get there. Well, our room faced the lobby of this apartment building, and there were the pigeonhole mailboxes, you know, where you, and so every morning I'd look to see if we had an envelope in our little slot.
Yeah.
So this one morning, there was, I went and I got it, got back in the room and looked at it, and it was my name typewritten with the address. There was a 3-cent stamp on it, but it hadn't been mailed. It had just been canceled.
Yeah.
So somebody had just put it in the slot. I opened it up.
Yeah.
And there was a $50 bill. And to this day, I don't know where that came from, because we didn't have that kind of money.
What do you think? It was someone in the building? Someone?
Everybody was poor. And somebody, if somebody did, they'd come out and say, look what I'm doing for you.
Or, right.
That was my ticket to UCLA.
And you have no idea?
No, to this day.
That's crazy. Yeah. So you went.
Yep. Now what happened was there was no major in journalism.
Sure.
You could join the Daily Bruin, the newspaper,
right,
and take a class in journalism, but there was no major.
Right.
So I got out the catalog and I'm looking through and I see Theater Arts English. There's Theater Arts Theater, Theater Arts Film,
right.
Theater Arts English.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, and it's offered playwriting courses and writing courses too. So I thought, well, like, I'll do that, and then I'll join the Daily Bruin. And Well, when you were a major in TA, Theater Arts, whether you wanted to be a writer or a director or whatever, as a freshman, you had to take an acting course.
There you go.
And you had to take scenery and lighting and costumes, aside from all your other classes. So there I am, and I'm in this acting class. I was terrible.
Yeah.
I was scared and all of that. But then I was in the class, and one of the other students, when we had to do another scene, said, well, would you want to do a scene from Red Peppers, which was Noel Coward?
Okay.
And I thought, well, that could be fun. And there was a little song in it, and but I had to be a Cockney, so I pretended to be Betty Grable with a Cockney.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of sang a little bit, and we got an A.
Yeah.
And then people started coming up to me, students, saying, would you be in my one act? Would you do this? So forth, so on. And then I, all of a sudden, I was doing a scene from a one act, and I was a hillbilly lady. And I came out, and I drew on my background of Texas and Arkansas. Sure. And I came out, and there was a couple of sentences that I said, and they laughed like crazy.
Yeah.
And I thought, I think I want to do this.
That was it.
Total out of the blue.
Yeah.
Accident.
You got hooked on the laughter.
I got hooked on the laughter. And then another student came up, and he was in the music department.
Yeah.
And he said, can you carry a tune? And I said, yeah, because my mom and I, we used to kind of sing in the kitchen with the ukulele. But I didn't ever belt or do solos.
Sure. Yeah.
And I said, yeah. He said, well, would you be in the chorus of a scene from South Pacific where the nurses are all singing with the lead, wash that man right out of my hair. And so this gal was the lead, and she was singing, and I was in the chorus. And I just belted, and they took me out of the chorus. And he said, would you do a scene from Guys and Dolls and sing Adelaide's Lament, which is a solo?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, gosh, I don't know. You know, and he said, well, it's a funny song, and she has a cold.
Okay.
In the song. She's lamenting because she has this terrible cold and is psychosomatic. And I said, well, if she has a cold, then I don't have to sound so good.
Uh-huh.
And, I, you know, if I hit a clam or something, a bad note, I can blame it on the cold. And so I belted that out, and that got great response. And I thought, okay, I want to be in musical comedy.
That was it.
That was it. Had there been a school of journalism, I wouldn't be talking to you now.
I know. What I wonder what you would have been doing.
I don't know.
Yeah, but that's, it's amazing to, like, I guess to find your talent at that age, it must be completely surprising.
Total.
Like, just, you're sort of like, you had no idea that was in you.
I was 18.
Yeah.
And I remember when I finally got the chance to go to New York, and I was going to get into Equity, you know, and I was going to change. There was somebody, some actress whose name was Carol Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, maybe I should change my name because my middle name is Creighton.
Yeah.
So I thought Carol Creighton, that was kind of nice sound. And then I thought, no, I want to be my own name because I had a crush on a boy in school, Tommy Tracy.
Yeah.
All through junior high school and high school. And I thought, if I ever make it, I want him to know.
That's you?
Because he never looked at me.
You got him.
I mean, all those little crazy things.
Sure. You hold on to that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, it's old resentments. You know, they may fade a little, but.
Did you want to be other than what you're doing now?
Well, I'm a comic, you know. I always wanted to be a comic.
Uh-huh.
But the interviewing thing came just out of strange timing,
really,
of this new medium.
Yeah,
and I was sort of I have a way of managing my talent to guarantee that I don't ever get really big. I don't want to let too much out. I just want to stay at this level. So when I started the podcast, I was in a valley. of, you know, in terms of what I was going to do with career-wise. And I had done some radio, and I was doing a lot of stand-up, but I couldn't really sell tickets at that time. And then podcasting started, you know, to kind of happen.
Yeah.
And we just got in on the ground floor, and my producer and I just decided to do two shows a week no matter
That's
what.
That's fabulous.
And at this point, I've interviewed, like, you know, almost 1,600 people.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, most of them creatives of one kind or another. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It started with comics of me basically apologizing for being an asshole to a lot of... a lot of my community, and that's what created the style of interview that I have.
I would love to hear the one you did with Jonathan.
Oh, my God. It was so wild because I drove up. I'll drive for people. Like, I did Jonathan, and, you know, he can get pretty dark. And, you know, and that's a known thing. But, you know, if that part of your brain lives there, you'll go there. Yeah. And it was very interesting because I drove up to Marin to interview Robin, too. And it's one of the only existing sort of candid conversations with him. You know, it was just him and I. And both of them kind of ruminated about suicide at the end of their interviews.
Wow.
It was kind of intense.
Oh, my gosh.
There was this, like, this arc of that connected them in so many ways, and there's a darkness to both of them.
And, of course, Robin adored Jonathan.
Loved him. Yeah. I mean, that was the whole thing. When you watch Jonathan, you're just like, where did
that come from?
Yeah. Were there other people like that?
Not to my knowledge.
Like, when you did...
I've never met other than Jonathan.
He was so funny. He was just so funny.
Yeah.
So when you get out of UCLA, you know, how do you get to New York?
Another weird thing. I was in the opera workshop, musical comedy workshop. And so once that I did Adelaide's Lament from Guys and Dolls. So,
sure.
So I loved being in that class.
Yeah.
So I was going to do a scene for the professor from Annie Get Your Gun.
Yeah.
There were about 9 of us in the class, and we picked different scenes. And so our professor said, my wife and I are being given a party in San Diego next week, next Saturday night, and it's a black tie affair. Why don't you kids come down? You'll be the entertainment for the party, and I'll grade you.
Right.
So I thought, wow. So we all got in cars and everything and went down. And I did my scene from Annie Get Your Gun.
Right.
And I went to the buffet table, and I'm stealing hors d'oeuvres in a napkin to take home to my grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
You know, put it in my purse, and there's a tap on my shoulder, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm busted.
Yeah.
And there was this gentleman and his wife, black tie. She's in a lovely gown.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I enjoyed you very much. I said, well, thank you. He says, so what do you want to do with your life? I said, well, someday I want to go to New York where I could be on musical comedy like Ethel Merman and Mary Martin.
Yeah.
He says, so why aren't you there now? And I said, I don't have the means. I hope someday I can save up enough money. And I had a part-time job as a cashier in a movie theater on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right.
75 cents an hour.
Wow.
So he said, I'll lend you the money to go to New York. And I thought, well, that's a champagne talking, you know?
Yeah.
And his wife said, no, he means it. He gave me his card. He said, be in my office a week from Monday.
Is he a show business guy?
Nope. Huh. He was a millionaire at that time, millionaire in the shipbuilding business.
Uh-huh.
He had an office in La Jolla, California. I went down. Also with the boy that I did the scene with, he offered it to him too.
Yeah.
So we drove down, went into his office at 9 o'clock that morning, and he said, okay. And he wrote out 2 $1,000 checks. He said, these are the stipulations. You must use the money to go to New York on. You must never reveal my name. And if you are successful, you must help others out.
And that was it.
And it's a loan. Pay it back in 5 years if you can.
Did you pay him
no
back?
No interest.
Yeah.
To the day I paid him back. Certified. And by then, I was in a show called Once Upon a Mattress.
That was the big one.
And it took me 5 years. That was 1954.
And what'd he say?
He never said a word. What happened was years later, when I had my show, his wife called. And she said, we'd love to have you come down and have lunch with us at the marina, you know, in San Diego. So we did. And he was very sweet. He was kind of quiet. And on the way back to the car, I was walking with her. And she said, you know, whenever, for any reason, if your name came up in a conversation or if you were on television and we were with other people, he never, ever, ever said a word.
Huh.
Never.
That's wild.
Yeah. And
you've never given his name.
No. Yeah. And so, but evidently he had helped other people out, not just in showbiz. She said he helped a young man start a restaurant once.
Huh.
Gave him the money to get that going because he believed that he could do something. You know, he trusted his instincts.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got to New York.
Great story. And then, you know, it all, and you paid him back, and then you pay it forward, and, and you're still aware of that.
It's weird things happened like that, $50.
Yeah. What is that one?
Yeah, I know.
Maybe he did that too.
No, I didn't know him then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get to New York, and I guess, like, in looking at some of the stuff about you, I know you were in that boarding house for women. Yeah. All talented people wanting to be in Broadway.
The Rehearsal Club, it's called.
Uh-huh.
And what happened was I was so naive, stupid.
Yeah.
I didn't know where I was going to live. I mean, my grandmother said, you can't go to New York. Look what we can do with all that money.
Yeah.
I said, I have to go, Nanny. That's what it's for.
Yeah.
She said, New York's cold. You'll be dead in a week. Your blood's too thin. So much for that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I said, I have to go. So it was August of 1954.
You went out there with that guy?
No, he came later. Yeah. So I was by my, and I got on a plane. I was so stupid. I didn't know where I was going to go.
Yeah.
I had one little cardboard suitcase, and that was about it. I'm on the plane, and I'm looking through the New Yorker magazine, and I see an ad for the Algonquin Hotel.
Sure. Why not?
Where the round table sat with all those brilliant people. I thought, well, I'll go there to start with. I had some money left out of the $1,000. You know, I had to pay for the ticket, and I had to have two wisdom teeth pulled. So that went south, you know. Yeah. So I was getting low on cash.
Yeah.
So I check into the Algonquin.
You did go.
I almost had a fit. It was $9. Now, our rent was $1 a day before. Yeah. $9 a night was a fortune.
Wow. Really?
And I thought, oh my God, what am I, oh God. But anyway, I had no place. So I thought, well, okay. I felt kind of alone in the hotel. I called home collect and they said, come home. We miss you. I just got there. I said, I have to stay. I'll keep in touch.
Yeah.
So I hung up and it started to rain. And I love rain.
Yeah.
I don't like it when it's flooding, but I love rain.
Yeah.
Good things had happened to me a lot of times when it rained.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, well, okay, I'm here in New York and it's raining. Turn on the radio. Hurricane Carol has hit New York. That was the name of the hurricane.
You're like, it's a sign.
I went, okay. So I had this one phone number, and it was the phone number of the girl who had done the lead in Watch That Man Right Out of My Hair that we did. She'd gone to New York a year before, and she'd gotten in touch with a friend and said, if Carol ever gets to New York, give her this number. So one number I had, Ellie.
Yeah.
And I called, and it was the Rehearsal Club. And I got a hold of her. She said, where are you? I said, I'm at the Algonquin. What are you doing in the Algonquin? Get out of there. Come up here. I'll try to get you a cot in the room, you know. And so I checked out, pouring rain, walked up and got into the Rehearsal Club. It was all these women running around with curlers in their hair, playing the piano, vocalizing. It was a beehive of activity. Yeah. And she introduced me to the house mother, Miss Carlton.
Yeah.
And she said, well, you're in luck. I have one cot available. And it was in this, what they call the transit room, which was on the first floor. And there were four other roommates in this one room. Five women, one bathroom, one closet, $18 a week, room and board. So
that's a good deal, right?
And I had a cot. And it was like heaven because I'd always slept on a couch. Now I have a cot.
And you're surrounded by talented people singing.
Yeah. And so I had these four roommates.
Yeah.
And they were all totally different characters. It was actually, we're working on making a series out of the rehearsal club.
Really?
In that era, in the 50s.
Oh, that would have been, that'd be great.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah.
Who's working on that with you?
Apple TV, maybe.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there are so many women, and we were all young and all, you know, anxious to do. There was a tap dancers. There were actresses. There were singers. There were opera singers. There were musicians. All kind. And there were each one, of course, have their own story.
Of course, yeah.
You know, so this is just, it's open for a lot of.
Oh, yeah. And all the light and darkness of trying to get into show business.
And some are good and some are not.
Right, exactly.
And some lose out on auditions. And, you know. So I have to get an agent. So I go around to, and so they would say, well, let us know when you're in something.
Yeah.
How do I get in something? You need an agent. It was Catch 22.
Sure.
So I finally got in to see one and showed him my scrapbook of UCLA rave reviews. He said, well, let me know when you're in something. I said, but how do I do that? He said, go put on your own show.
He told you to do that.
I said, okay.
Yeah.
I went back to the club, called a meeting with all the girls.
Right.
I said, let's put on a show. And we wrote our own material. And we got these ladies, rich ladies in New York, who sponsored the club, which was why the rent was so cheap.
Yeah.
Inexpensive.
Yeah.
And they gave us $200 to hire a concert hall. Carl Fisher Concert Hall on 57th for two nights. We sent penny postcards out to every agent, director, producer in town saying, you're always saying, let us know when you're in something. Well, the girls of the rehearsal club are in something. This is your ticket. Please come and see us.
Yeah.
We were packed for two nights and three of us got agents right away.
And that's how it happened. And you were, what were you doing? What was your act?
I did a takeoff. On, there was a show called New Faces of 1952, where Eartha Kitt, who was a sexy singer, sang a song called Monotonous, where she went from one chaise lounge to another, very, very sexy.
Yeah.
Very sexy. Singing about her life was so monotonous because everybody wanted her and all that.
Yeah.
So I did it with three broken down kitchen chairs. Yeah. As a woman with an apron on, just and curlers in my hair, singing how my life is monotonous.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Big laugh.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, like, you know, the first bit that you did that made you want to do comedy, you know, really becomes a character on the Burnett Show in a way.
The charwoman, Yeah.
And then this one becomes some version of the cleaning lady, right?
It's
wild.
Yeah.
That there are these things have been with you your whole life.
Yeah.
But when, like, what I'm curious about is, like, once you get an agent and you're in New York, and I don't know when the John Foster Dulles song happened.
That it was in 57.
So that, okay, so that was later, a couple of years later?
Yeah.
Is that when you have an act?
Yeah.
That started the act.
Yeah. But what happened was, once I got the agent in 54, was when we did the Reserves Club Review.
Yeah.
So I, for that summer in 55, I went to a summer stock.
Yeah.
At, called Green Mansions in the Adirondacks.
Okay.
And it was 10 weeks, $500.
How many shows did you do?
Four a week, four different shows a week. We'd do a play.
Yeah.
We would do an opera. We would do an original musical comedy. It was tough.
An opera?
Yeah. But others did the opera. Yeah. I did maybe a little bit. But then we would do a musical comedy. Yeah. We would do sketches, a review, all of that.
So this was the education.
Oh, total education. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
And guess who was there with me?
Who?
Sheldon Harnick, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, eventually.
Yeah.
And She Loves Me. Adams and Strauss, who wrote Bye Bye Birdie.
They were there?
We were all together. We were new.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they were a little bit older than I was, but maybe 5 years older or something.
So that was sort of the musical comedy version of the Catskills.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the following summer, I went to Tamamut, which was in the Poconos.
Yeah.
And that was the same kind of a thing where we would do, it was a little easier because we didn't do that many different things. We did a musical, original musical, and a musical comedy review every week.
Okay.
And there was Artie Johnson.
Really?
Yeah.
Was he always funny?
Yeah. 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 And we had just wonderful training. And Larry Kurt, who later on became the first lead in West Side Story.
Wow. So this is really the, the training ground.
They don't have it anymore.
No, they don't have a lot of things anymore.
I know. It's just, it's so sad because it was such good training.
And all these people who were creative people that, it, you know, you get this all this skill set that would ultimately lead to, you know, a variety show, but also just Broadway.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what were the audiences like? Were they just...
They were people who came to...
For the summer kind of deal?
Well, for the week. They would change each week.
Okay.
There would be new group of people coming in.
Yeah.
And we had to be good because... We offered ourselves there, and if they didn't want to come, they would be going out in a canoe and necking, you know.
Yeah.
And they were looking to hook up.
Sure.
A lot of the people who came. Yeah. Yeah, they were mostly single.
Okay.
You know, so.
So the show had to be fun.
Had to be good for to keep them there, yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Because it really is like, you know, on the other side, it sounds like the Catskills experience for stand-ups.
Yeah, right. Right.
The audience was different.
Yeah.
I think they were a little
you know,
middle-class Jewish people going up there as married and family.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the theater thing was just fun.
Well, it was great. And that's when they wrote Once Upon a Mattress. Mary Rogers, who wrote the music and all. And they created Once Upon a Mattress. I wasn't there then.
Right.
That was after I was there.
So when you come back to New York after doing these for 2 years, you have an act?
Well, Ken Welch, who was a piano player at one of the auditions I went to, followed me after I had auditioned for one of the summer stock places, and he gave me his card. He was a special material writer. And he said, I really loved what you did, and so if you ever need a coach or a special material, please call me.
Yeah.
So after I got Green Mansions and I came back to New York and I was living at the club, I called him. And I was part-time checking hats at ladies' tea room for money, you know, which is not too many women check their hats, but they check packages and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I would pay him. It was $10 a session. I'd pay him in quarters and dimes and nickels for my tip.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote the John Foster Dulles number. And we auditioned that for the Blue Angel. And they hired me.
The club.
The club.
Yeah.
And then he wrote a 20-minute act. He wound up being, along then later on with his wife, special material writers for me until maybe they died 5 years ago.
Oh, my God.
They did all my specials with Beverly Sills, with Placido Domingo, with Julie Andrews.
Oh, yeah.
They wrote all of those specials, and they wrote on my show.
Wow, so that was some relationship.
It was, yeah.
And the act, was it like a cabaret act, basically?
Yeah, yeah. And I would say, oh, the different types of singers.
Okay.
Here's the one who's auditioning and very nervous.
Oh, yeah.
And then I would do her. Then so here's the one who's got more confidence than Ethel Merman, and I would do her. So I would go into character. I wasn't a stand-up doing jokes. I couldn't do
Were
it.
Were you on bills with stand-ups?
Yeah. And also I was on a bill with Mike and Elaine.
Oh, my
Mike
goodness.
Nichols and Elaine
sure,
Bing.
Sure.
That's how we met.
That's how you met Mike Nichols?
Yep.
Who went on also to
Julie write.
Julie Andrews and you.
Yeah. He wrote, with Ken Welch, he wrote Carnegie Hall.
Wow. So you're on a bill. What club was that?
The Blue Angel nightclub.
So you saw them do their bit. That must have been great.
Insane.
Yeah.
It was so fabulous.
And the show was usually, what, two or three acts?
There would be four acts, and it would be like 20 minutes a session, and you do two a night.
Okay.
One at 8 o'clock and another around midnight.
So that was mostly, those were the gigs you were doing when you did live
so
shows.
So then what happened was I did the Dulles number, and I got on the Parr show, Jack Parr.
To do that number.
And I did that number, and all hell broke loose.
Right.
I went back to do the midnight show, and the phones were ringing off the hook. some people very upset about that girl who did that number.
They were upset.
So some people were, and some people got it.
So John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State.
Yep.
Notoriously sort of seemingly a boring guy.
Well, yeah, he was aptly named.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. So what happened was one of the calls that night, that was a Tuesday, was from a man named David Waters, who was his television representative.
Sure.
And he said, Mr. Dulles didn't see it, but could you go back on the Parr show Thursday? Yeah. So Jack Parr had me back on Thursday.
Yeah.
Then Ed Sullivan called, and I did it on Sunday. So three times that week, I did the Dulles number.
And those are the only shows people are watching.
There was right. Like it was two, like, and I was on.
Everyone in the world.
I was in like the editorial pages and stuff, on and on and on. You know. And of course, then as hot as I was that week, I was as cold in the next 2 weeks as a fit.
Well, that's interesting about a novelty song, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was just a girl who sang. But what I love was the following week, Dulles was on Meet the Press.
Uh-huh.
And I'm watching. And so towards the end, right at the end, before they're signing off the interview, said, Mr. Dulles, I just have one question. What is this thing that's going on between you and that girl who sings that love song about you? And I'm watching the television. Oh, my God. And he got a twinkle in his eye, and he said, I make it a matter of policy never to discuss matters of the heart in public. He had a sense of humor.
That's great.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. You went all the way to the top. You were in the White House with that thing.
Yeah, right.
And so, but it didn't lead anywhere? Of course it did.
Not really. It was just, you know, so I, you know, then I was, I kept doing my nightclub act. And then I remember when I was going to go to New York and my friends from UCLA gave me a bon voyage party.
Yeah.
And they said, what are you going to do when you get to New York? I said, I'm going to be in a Broadway show directed by George Abbott someday.
Yeah.
So now I'm home.
In New York.
New York.
Now, are you married?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I married the boy that I did the number with.
The other $1,000 guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we were raising my kid's sister. I brought her back to live with me.
What's the age difference?
I'm 11 years older, so she was a teenager.
Is she still around?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
And so I was up for a role. They were going to redo Babes in Arms, Oscar Hammerstein Richard Rodgers. And they were going to open it in Florida. And I auditioned, and they liked me. And they thought they were going to hire me to sing Johnny One Note, which is a major song. And I thought I had it. And the director called. He wanted me, but he said, Carol, I'm sorry, but you're not going to. They want a name.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I was really disappointed. And my kid sister said, we still call each other Sissy. She said, Sissy, now you know the cliche. You always say one door closes, another will open.
Yeah.
You know? The phone rang that instant. I picked it up, and it was the producers of a show called Once Upon a Mattress said,
right.
Would you like to come down now and audition for George Abbott? We're doing what?
Come on.
I got in the subway, went down that afternoon. Then I lost the other job.
Right.
Sang for George Abbott. Got on the subway, came home. The phone was ringing. I had the part. The $50.
Yeah.
The $1,000.
Yeah.
George Abbott.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, I got a little angel here.
Yeah, somewhere. It seems like it. You know, so that show was off-Broadway at first?
It was off-Broadway.
And then?
And it was only going to be a six-week run because it's a subscription. And I had a little bit of Rosalind Russell in me. I don't know if you know what I mean, but of making things happen.
Yeah.
I remembered her in a movie called Front Page.
Yeah.
And she was grabbed the bull by the horns and I thought, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be Rosalind Russell. And I started a campaign to move us to another theater.
Okay.
Don't close us.
Yeah, yeah.
Move us to Broadway.
Oh, you were pushing for that.
So what we did was, we made up signs and we were in our costumes after we took the bows.
Yeah.
We'd run out in front of the theater as the audience is coming out And the sign would say, a house, our kingdom for a house, find a house for mattress. Or yeah. And they moved us to the Alvin.
Uh-huh.
And we played there until another show was coming in. Then they moved us to the Winter Garden.
Uh-huh.
We played there until another show came
like
in.
And it's like selling out. It's packing out.
Yep.
It's the thing to do.
Yeah. And they put us to six different theaters in 1 year. I remember Neil Simon said, have you seen Mattress yet? Don't worry. It'll soon be at your neighborhood theater. And we ran. I left after a year. But I was in it for a whole year. And then by then I was also doubling with Gary Moore.
You got the Gary Moore variety show.
Right.
And did you find theater like over and over again kind of boring?
Yeah, I finally did. I thought I was going to be a theater person.
Yeah.
I never thought of television. We didn't even have a television.
Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up. And I got the Gary Moore gig. And I loved the idea of being different characters every week.
Sure.
Different songs every week.
Yeah.
A different challenge every week, that became more interesting to me than having to do the same thing eight shows a week.
Yeah, because like, you know, you never know an audience and, you know, and it just, yeah. It's hard to make it fresh, I would imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to remember that even though you've done it 100 times, this is the first time the audience is seeing it.
Yes.
So you really have to gear yourself up for that.
Yeah.
But I doubled.
Yeah.
And
well, it must have given you a new life to things.
Well, I was young too, and you know.
And so that was really the big TV break, Gary Moore, and you're doing bit parts here and there.
No, not really, because I was doubling with Mattress.
Sure, and you were a regular on Gary Moore.
Yeah, and I won an Emmy.
That's amazing.
I won my first Emmy on Gary's show.
So then what, like, when do you start doing, you did the Jack Benny show at some point?
Oh, that was when we moved out to California.
Oh, all that happened. So what brings you to California?
I was married and
to the same guy?
No.
New guy.
No, the producer of the Gary Moore show, actually.
What was his name?
Joe Hamilton.
Yeah, Joe Hamilton. Yeah. So he was your producer forever.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so with the Gary Moore show, I was going to leave the show.
Yeah.
And so the agent worked out a deal with CBS.
Right.
And I was doing really well.
On Gary Moore. And you're an Emmy winner.
Yeah.
It's so funny because when I was a kid, I can remember your show, but I remember Gary Moore was like, was he Truth or Consequences? What was the game show?
No,
No, it's when they...
No, it's To Tell the Truth.
To Tell the Truth.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. It's interesting, those jobs. Because he was like, you know, a variety guy, funny
he
guy.
He was. He was, you know what, he was also one of the kindest. You never hear too many people say this, but I was a second banana, which means supporting. And Durward Kirby was, and he was very funny.
I remember that guy.
And so we'd be at a table read on Monday for Friday's show.
Yeah.
And if Gary had a punchline or a joke or something, and he said, you know what? Give this line to Carol or give it to Durward. They can say it funnier than I can. He was that generous.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to do when I got my show. I wanted to give it to Harvey.
Sure.
I wanted to give it to Tim, to Vicky. We should all score. It's a rep company.
Yeah.
Might have my name on it, but I'll support Tim in a sketch. Harvey will support Vicky in a sketch.
But
Vicky,
it's so funny. You guys, there's no... I imagine Gary Moore was a bit of a straight man, no?
Yes.
So, like, your show, there wasn't really a straight man. Maybe Lyle.
Occasionally. But then we gave him some... And he turned out to be pretty funny at times.
He was
funny.
So how the deal was structured? So you had to deal with CBS.
Oh, yes. What happened was, the deal with CBS was, I signed a contract for 10 years, and which would mean I would do one special a year and two guest shots.
Okay. Yeah.
One of their sitcoms or whatever. But within the first 5 years, if I, Carol, wanted to do an hour-long comedy variety show, all I had to do was push the button, and CBS would have to put it on for 30 shows within the first 5 years. And I thought, well, I could never be a host. So now, Joe and I have a baby, are in California. I'm not that in demand that much anymore.
Is your grandma still around?
Not then. No, no. But she did get to see me in Mattress.
Oh, okay.
And so it's the last week of the fifth year. And we just put a down payment on a house in Beverly. And we look around, and Joe So maybe we should push that button.
Huh.
So, okay. So Christmas is between Christmas and New Year's, and it would be over in another week, right? Uh-huh. So I called New York and talked to one of the vice presidents, and he said, oh, did you have a nice Christmas? Yeah. I said, hey, Mike, I'm calling because I want to push that button. He said, what button? They didn't remember. And I said, you know, where I get to do 31-hour shows, comedy variety, let me get back to you.
Yes.
So I'm sure they got a lot of lawyers out of some Christmas parties that night.
Yeah.
He called the next day. He said, yeah, Carol, I see. He said, but you know, comedy variety is a man's game.
Mm.
He said, it's not for you gals.
So who are those? Who's he talking about? Like Dean Martin?
No, Sid Caesar.
Okay.
Jackie Gleason.
Right.
Milton Berle. And now Dean Martin.
Yeah.
And he said, we've got this sitcom maybe we'd love you to do called Here's Agnes. Can you picture it?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Here's Agnes. And I said, I don't want to be Agnes every week. I want to be different people. I want to have a rep company. I want guest stars. I want dancers. I want music.
Yeah.
They had to put us on the air.
And who was the original crew?
Harvey, Vicky, and Lyle.
And how'd you find them?
Well, I seen Harvey on the Danny Kaye show.
Yeah.
He was a great second banana. He was like Carl Reiner was with Sid Caesar.
Uh-huh.
And I said, we've got to get to Harvey Corp finally. Sure. But Danny's show was going off the air as we were going to go on.
Right.
So I saw Harvey in the parking lot at CBS, and I said, you got to be on our show. And then we worked it out.
Yeah.
So we got Harvey.
Yeah.
Carl Reiner had said, you know, you ought to get a good-looking hunk as an announcer for you to go crazy over at times.
Yeah.
You know? So we auditioned, and then Lyle came in. Of course, he looked beautiful.
Yeah.
But he was also funny.
Yeah.
Vicky, this is January of 1967. Yeah. We're going to go on the air in September of 67. And we were thinking about doing a sketch every so often where Harvey and I are a married couple.
Yeah.
And we're raising my kid sister.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm at home and I'm reading fan mail.
Yeah.
Open this letter from this girl.
Yeah.
Vicki Lawrence. Mm. Says, everybody says that I remind them of a young you and I want to be in showbiz. It was very sweet. And then she enclosed a newspaper article that had her picture in it of her hometown newspaper in Englewood. And she was going to be in a contest called Miss Fireball of Englewood.
Yeah.
And so they were featuring, there were nine other girls.
Yeah.
And each day they were featuring an article on each one of the girls. So she sent me her article. And she looked more like me at 17 than I did. You know, I thought maybe she might be good for this role.
Yeah.
So I look at the date, and the date of the Miss Fireball contest is tonight, because they sent it from CBS 2 weeks ago or whatever.
Yeah.
And the contest is, I just got the, so Joe coming downstairs, I said, don't get too comfortable. We're going to go see the Miss Fireball contest in Inglewood tonight.
Yeah.
What are you talking? I said, look at that. He said, well, shouldn't you call her and tell her? I said, yeah, I should. Her father's name was listed in the article, Howard Lawrence. So I dialed information, got her phone number.
Yeah.
Ring, ring. This lady answers, hello. I said, hi, is Vicki Lawrence there? She said, this is her mother. Who's calling? And I said, it's Carol Burnett. Vicki!
Yeah.
Vicki gets on the phone and says, yeah, hi, Marcia. Yeah. She thought somebody was putting her
right
on.
Right.
I said, it's not Marcia. I got your letter. Would you be comfortable if we come to see you tonight in the contest? Yeah, okay. We went, sorry, she won the contest.
Yeah.
I said, we'll be in touch. We got hold of her the following summer.
Yeah.
She came and auditioned.
Yeah.
And
that was it.
Today, no network would let me do that.
Yeah.
They would not let you hire somebody right out of high school that had no experience.
Yeah.
But CBS let us do it. And it took a while, but she started to just absorb everything. Harvey took her under his wing and taught her what to do with props, how to listen and how to react. He gave her, he helped her with accents.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a master class. And she learned her trade in front of 30 million people every week.
And she was so good.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
And here she was going to be a dental hygienist.
Oh, my God. And she did some singing. I remember we had an 8-track.
Oh, yeah. So
like, that's the night the lights went out in Georgia,
yeah.
Right?
That was it. She won a gold record.
Yeah. She did all right. So now you're off and running with this show, and you got Lyle, you got Harvey, mm-hmm. and you got Vicky.
And we would have Tim on every month. I mean, he had his own show for a while, a couple of shows. And it wasn't until our 9th year that we had him on every week. People thought he was a regular for the whole time. But we had him on so many times.
It's just too much. what was it? How did writing work on the show?
We had all our comedy writers would get together. And
what was the staff? How big?
We had maybe six or seven writers with a head writer. Then we would have the special material writers, which was Ken Mitzi.
Sure, for the music stuff.
For the music stuff. Choreographer, Ernie Flatt, who was the choreographer for the Gary Moore show.
Okay.
And we had, and so I would sometimes go and say, you know, because I love doing the movie takeoffs. Yeah. And I said, could we do Mildred Pierce maybe, you know?
Yeah.
Or Postman Always Rings Twice, or some of the Double Indemnity.
Uh-huh.
So they'd get to work, and maybe in 3 weeks, I'd have their Mildred Fierce, we called her. And we'd do that. You know.
Yeah.
And lots of times, Harvey and Vicky and I, we would be rehearsing. And if we thought of a better line or something, we'd put it in. We'd have the writers come down and look at it. They were so good. They would say, listen, if you can make it better, they weren't that into their own...
Yeah, but they were also working for you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but they were very, you know, and there were times, too, when if I wasn't comfortable with something, because I was a woman.
Yeah.
See, Jackie Gleason or Sid Caesar would say, come on, guys, this sucks. Sure. Come on, you got to fix this. And they would be, it'd be fine. But if a woman did that at that time, she would be a bitch.
Right.
So I would tiptoe and tap dance around. I'd say, you know, guys, come on down. I'm not doing this too. Do you think you can help me out?
Right. Yeah.
So that was the way I could get away with and not hurt their feelings.
Oh, that's something. You know? You were aware of that early on.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know Gleason?
Yeah. I met him at a couple of parties at Bob Hope's house.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did you know a lot of those guys, all those,
Well, I had Sid Caesar on my show.
Sure, I saw that clip.
And I was thrilled because I used to, when I was at the rehearsal club, I wouldn't miss Caesar's Hour on Saturday night.
Right.
It was a live 90-minute show with him, Carl, Nanette Fabre.
Oh, who you had on your show.
Yeah,
she was a lot.
She
was so funny. Yeah, yeah, she's so funny.
Yeah, and I just loved his work. And that's kind of what I patterned my show after, that and Gary's show. To do sketches and stuff, you know, and musical numbers.
Well, I mean, I think it seems like it was the only one that really like took the sketches as seriously you saw bits on other shows that didn't seem to, you know,
we would do 15-minute pieces.
Yeah.
You know, and we really got serious at times with the family.
I know, yeah.
With Eunice and Mama and all. And there was one time we were rehearsing. And I just said to Harvey, I said, let's just right now in rehearsal, do it straight without the accents and play it straight. Don't change a line. It was devastating.
To feel the emotion of it?
Oh, my gosh. But then once we added the spin to it with the accents and the this and that and a little over the top, then it became funny. But there were no jokes in it. It was all character driven.
Well, I imagine that in particular, that recurring sketch, I think, you know, somehow or another for the general public, they must have felt very seen by the stuff you were doing.
Well, a lot of the male said it was a dysfunctional family.
Sure.
And a lot of the male I would go and say, this reminds me of times with my family when I would do this. And one time I was getting a manicure and she was Russian. She's filing my nails. She said, you know that family you do? I said, yes. She said, it's like my family in Russia. So, It's worldwide.
It's yeah.
It's worldwide.
Right. It's just the emotions of dysfunction.
And what was funny was we never knew we were going to do it more than once. So they were going to have me play Mama and get a guest star to play Eunice. And I said, you know, Eunice speaks to me because it reminded me of my mother with her dreams that didn't come true.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were going to hire an older lady to come in and be Mama. And Bob Mackey, our costume designer, said, because we were thinking, who could we get in? And Vicky had grown then in her comedy. Bob Mackey, our costume designer, said, let's have Vicky do it. We'll put her in a fat suit, take her eyelashes off, and put her in a wig. She can be Mama.
Yeah. And it worked.
She was 24 years old. I'm 16 years older than she is, and I'm playing her daughter. She was fabulous.
Yeah, it was great.
And it just became this whole thing.
Like, because of the ensemble, it seemed like you really had your own world there. And, you know, outside of like a lot of what was going on. Yeah, I mean, you had guests. How did the booking work?
We would just say, you know, I'd love to have so-and-so on.
And invite them?
And we'd call.
Yeah, and they'd come?
Yeah, and oh my God, to have Betty Grable on.
Everybody.
Rita Hayworth.
Sure.
Lana Turner.
Everybody.
Bing Crosby.
Yes.
I mean.
You got to sing with your heroes.
Right.
Yeah. And but we didn't talk about the Julie Andrews thing. I mean, that the Carnegie Hall before you left New York.
Right.
That was an interesting pairing that just sort of happened.
Well, she was a guest on the Gary Moore Show.
Okay. And you guys met?
And yeah. And well, actually, she came to see me in Mattress.
Okay.
And we, some friends said, you girls should get to know each other. I know you'd like each other. And by then, she was in Camelot.
Uh huh.
So, but she was off that night and she came and with her manager and the friend of mine. And afterwards, we went to a Chinese restaurant. Those poor men had no, they couldn't, we were like long lost sisters.
Yes.
And it just clicked. So when she was on Gary's show, Ken Welch, the special material writer, wrote a whole thing about on Big D where we played cowboys.
Yeah.
And we did that on Gary's show. And it's the first time I've ever seen a television audience give a standing ovation. So the idea was born that we should do a special together.
Uh-huh.
And the thought, Carnegie Hall. And so I remember Bob Banner, who was the executive producer of the Gary Moore Show, said, tried to push it to CBS, and they didn't want it.
Huh.
They said, you know, Carol, everybody sees you every week, and nobody knows who Julie Andrews is, because she hadn't, outside of My Fair Lady, because she hadn't done a movie yet.
Right.
So it didn't dawn on them. Now I'm at an affiliates luncheon with CBS at a table, and I don't know, I had quite a mouth on me. I said, well, you know, if you guys don't want to do it, we could go over to NBC. At least they're in color, you know. And they still want, you know.
Yeah.
And so after the luncheon, it's raining.
Yeah.
They come down, and the two vice presidents are saying, we'll wait and see if you can get a cab, and we'll help you. You know, I said, oh, don't worry, I'll be fine. I said, somebody's going to pull up and give me a ride?
Yeah.
What? Again.
Come on.
A beer truck pulled up.
Yeah.
And the guy leans out and says, hey, Carol, you want a lift? They hoisted me up into the cab.
Yeah.
The guy drove me home to Central Park South.
Right.
I thanked him so much. I got out. The phone is ringing. Open the door. It's Oscar Katz, who was the vice president of CBS.
Yeah.
You got your show.
Because of the beer truck?
Yeah. If somebody recognized me, it was a whole... And I said that, it was like, okay, well, something's going on here.
Right.
And we got the show.
That's great. And how'd you get Mike Nichols to come on?
Julie.
Yeah.
Yeah, Julie knew him better than I did.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, he's a very good writer.
Yes.
And then Kenny Weaver, of course, was going to do all the special material. Sure. And so, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel like, did you ever have bits that bombed?
Oh, yeah.
Because it felt like because of the nature of the ensemble that none of you would let that happen.
Well, we were doing one sketch called Mary Worthless. And there was a cartoon called Mary Worth.
Yeah.
I mean, she was this kindly old lady who would enter people's lives and solve their problems.
Yeah.
So we thought it'd be funny if I'm Mary Worthless and I go in and I screw everything up.
Right.
With this couple, you know, she's nosy. She does everything wrong. And then at the end, I was saying, I was supposed to say. And that was what I did this week. So stay tuned, because pretty soon you'll see more of Mary Worthless.
Yeah.
You know, well, we did it. It was awful.
Oh.
It was just, the audience looked like an oil painting.
Oh, no. Just,
and I, so now it comes from me to say, I said, I was going to say to tune in and see, but I am never going to do this character again. And it went on the air.
It did?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that saved it then. Now, I know we all tried to not laugh, but boy.
No, we didn't. It was never on purpose.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But Conway would go off script.
Yeah.
And it was gold.
Yeah.
Let him.
Well, why? Because Harvey couldn't control himself.
And Harvey hated himself, because he was very proud of his comedy chops.
Yes.
He was very serious about it.
Yeah.
But Conway, all he had to do was just look at him in a funny way, and Harvey was gone.
But that added to it.
Oh, of course.
And you had a pretty good friendship with Lucy, right?
Yes.
And did she, like, how did that work? Did she see you and realize?
She came to see me in Mattress.
Okay.
The second night. And yeah. I was so nervous. She came backstage. She called me kid.
Yeah.
Because she was 22 years older.
Yeah.
And she said, a kid, if you ever need me for anything. She was so sweet.
Yeah.
So, like, about 4 years later, I was going to do a special.
Yeah.
And only if I could get a big guest star.
Uh-huh.
So Bob Banner, who was the executive, said, call Lucy.
Right.
And I said, I didn't want to bother her. You know, it's years ago.
Sure.
All she can do is say, I'd love to, but I'm busy. I got her on the phone. And I said, she said, you're doing great, kid. And what is it? What's going on? I was fumfering. I said, oh, you know, I'm going to do, but I know you're busy. She said, when do you want me?
Yeah.
So we did the special. So that's how that happened.
How funny was that?
Oh, she was great. And we did a song called Chutzpah
yeah.
at the end, where we were two cleaning ladies.
Yeah.
And Ken Welch and Mitzi wrote that. And
yeah.
So then she did my show as a guest. Mm. She did three of them.
Yeah.
So my husband, Joe,
yeah.
was producing our show.
Yeah.
Okay. And so Lucy was a guest, and we had a break, and we went over to the farmer's market to have a little bite to eat.
Oh, right there at CVS?
Yeah. Yeah. So to eat before orchestra rehearsal. So she's sitting there and she's having a whiskey sour. She's going to knock him one back. And she said, you know, kid, it's great you got Joe to be the producer. She said, because when I was married to the Cuban,
yeah,
because they were divorced by
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
She said, he did everything. He took care of the scripts. He took care of the lighting. He was the one who invented the three camera system.
Yeah.
And he was everything. So that when I came in on Monday, everything was perfect. All I had to do was be silly Lucy.
Yeah.
Then we got a divorce. And she said, now I'm going to be Lucy Carmichael and do those other,
the
Lucille
show?
Ball show, the yeah. Lucy show. She said, so I go into, I read the script, and she said, it's terrible. It stank. There wasn't Desi there who would have fixed it. And she said, I didn't know what to do. I thought, oh, my God. So she said, she called lunch, and she said, I went into my office, and I said, and I thought, I've got to be like Desi. I've got to be tough. I've got to be, you know.
Yeah.
She said, so I went back, and she said, and I told him in no uncertain terms, she said, I channeled Desi. And then she said, and kid, and she took another drink. She said, and that's when they put the S on the end of my last name.
Yeah. Yeah. She seemed tough.
Oh, she was great. She sent me, oh, this is sweet. She sent me flowers yeah. on my birthday every year.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, kid. And so in the morning of my 56th birthday,
yeah.
I got up, turned on the news. She died on my birthday.
Oh, my God.
And I got her flowers that afternoon.
Wow. That's touching.
Yeah.
Sad, but beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, I had talked to Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a while back. And I'm driving down here, and I realized, like, well, his dad was best friends with Tim.
Yeah,
and
Ernie.
Ernie. Mm-hmm. So you knew Ernie.
He was on our show a few times.
Yeah.
And at one point, after Lyle left, he was our announcer.
Was Paul Thomas Anderson hanging around?
He was a baby.
Yeah.
Well, I knew Paulie. Even before he was born. Yeah. You know, they had five kids, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Because his dad, he seemed like a character.
Oh, he was. He was a character.
Yeah.
He and Tim were partners back in Cleveland, Ohio, right, on television. Ernie was a magician.
Oh, Goulardi.
The great Goulardi.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And in terms of doing films, I mean, it doesn't, like, did you like doing it?
Certain ones, yes, I had fun.
Yeah.
Others, I didn't.
A lot of waiting, right?
Yeah. But I loved working with Bob Altman.
Oh, for The Wedding?
Yeah, Wedding, Health. None of the films did well, but he was so great to work for.
But Annie was huge, right?
Annie was huge.
Yeah.
And Houston was very good.
It's an interesting movie for him that you got to work with that guy.
Yeah, it was strange. I always thought that maybe Ray Stark called him up to play Daddy Warbucks, because John Huston would have been...
Who was it, Albert Finney? Who did it?
He did, yeah. But I just have a feeling that he said, no, but... And then Ray said, well, then will you direct?
I wonder if that's how it went down.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I know that, you know, your daughter... struggled with addiction and stuff, and
got sober just before she turned 18.
Oh wow! Now, did you do the Al-Anon thing too, or no?
Yeah, I did. Oh, yeah. And then she became quite a good actress.
Yes,
and she did a little cult film called Tokyo Pop, which they've just reissued.
Oh, that's exciting!
And I remember she got a call from Marlon Brando.
Come on, yeah.
Who wanted to meet with her for a project.
Huh.
She turned him down. Huh. I became a stage mother. I said, are you crazy? She said, Mom, I did the movie. Now I want to concentrate on writing my music. Uh-huh. And I want to concentrate on directing. She had all of that. X-Files was on.
Yeah.
And Vince Gilligan, who later created Breaking Bad, was on, a writer on X-Files.
Yeah.
And she was... in an episode that he wrote. And when I got to know Vince...
When you did Better Call Saul?
Well, I got to know him even before that.
Oh, yeah.
And he said Carrie was their favorite guest.
Oh, that's sweet.
She was a really good actress. Yeah. And they wanted to have her back.
Yeah. Mm. So sad. She got sick, huh?
Yeah.
Now, what was this thing I read about you taking AA to Russia with...
Oh, God. Carrie and I did, yeah.
How does that happen? How do you decide to take Alcoholics Anonymous to Russia?
There was a man, and I can't think of his name, whom I had met when I did a movie called Life of the Party.
Oh, yeah.
About a woman, Beatrice, who was actually, is a true story. She got the first woman's home for alcoholic women in L.A.
Okay.
And she was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
But got sober, and so I did a movie about her. So I met him, and he said he had gone to Russia a few times, and he said, if we show that movie in Russia, would you come?
Wow.
And so I took Carrie with me, and we went, because she could talk to the young people.
Right.
And we had an interpreter.
Yeah.
And they showed that movie with subtitles, throughout entire 11 time zones.
Yeah.
In Russia.
Wow.
Yeah. And
had an impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if it lasted.
Right.
You know, but and they wanted to bring Alcoholics Anonymous over there. So the best way to introduce it would be.
Oh, that's that interesting. Film. Sure. Wow. That's a whole journey.
That was a long time ago.
Never knew what you're going to do that.
Yeah. No.
And now the acting, like, see, I'm 60 and I'm already tired. So like in terms of like working, do you just love it? Or you just want to stay busy?
Well, only if it's going to be fun.
Yeah. And you had fun on Better Call Saul?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. And Odin Kirk and I and Ray Seahorn, we're like this now.
They're great.
I made all kinds of new friends in the past 3 years.
Sure.
With him and Ray and Saul. And, of course, Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, all of them. Yeah. It was one of the... best experiences I've ever had.
And Glee, that was great. And
yeah.
Lynch.
Yeah, on Jane. We see Jane. She lives up here.
Oh, she does?
Yeah.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, we just had dinner with her a couple of weeks ago.
Mad About You, you got an Emmy, right, for that?
Yeah.
That's great. And then now this new one, like I said, I enjoyed it a lot. It seemed like fun. And these period pieces are kind of amazing when they're done that well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that the idea for the rehearsal house as a period piece would be amazing.
I think so, too.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing
it. Being with you.
Yeah, it was fun. Okay, that was beautiful and amazing for me. I hope it was for you, too. Palm Royale is now streaming on Apple TV Plus. A new episode stream on Wednesdays. Hang out for a minute. Okay, folks, in 2016, I had a great talk with Carol's Palm Royale co-star, Kristen Wiig. It's a great talk, and you can listen to it now for free in whatever podcast app you're using. It's episode 734. You were a closet goth girl?
Yeah, I got into it more after high school. I kind of embraced my... It wasn't goth so much, but...
Emotional.
Not music. Conforming to, fashion and, coloring my hair and, piercing.
Radical. Things. What'd you pierce?
Well, I pierced my nose and, a few in my ear and my belly button and my tongue.
You did all of that?
Yes.
And they're all gone now?
They're all gone. I have, a little one up here at the top of my ear. Actually, I got that one in New York when I was on SNL, but...
Oh, so that was a more recent
piercing. That's a more recent one.
No, never throw the tongue post in?
No, that closes up after, an hour. It's like an alien. Yeah.
So you're all pierced up but no tats?
No, I had tats. Yeah, I've got three, and one of them I'm in the process of removing, and that's the one I got at that time.
Oh, yeah? Where
is
it?
It's so ugly. Where do you think?
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
On your lower back?
Yeah. I mean, it's not lower back. I try to say it's not a tramp stamp. I'm like, it's higher than a tramp stamp. Uh-huh. It's a little higher. Uh-huh.
Again, that's episode 734 with Kristen Wiig. To get every episode of WTF ad-free, sign up for WTF Plus by going to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.